Today is Monday, August 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, protests in Hong Kong have continued for an 11th straight week.
It's checked that more people are aware on the crackdown on human rights and continue the fight.
We take a look at where things go from here as protests spread to other countries. Also ahead, Russian President Vladimir Putin is in France as world leaders prepare for the G7 summit. And a look at cutting-edge research being performed at government and university labs across the United States. Those stories and more are all coming up. Hong Kong is gearing up for further protests this week after hundreds of thousands of anti-government demonstrators braved heavy rain to rally peacefully on Sunday, marking a change to what have often been violent clashes. Sunday's massive turnout, which organizers put at 1.7 million individuals, showed that the movement still has widespread support despite chaotic scenes last week when protesters occupied the Chinese-ruled city's airport. Joshua Wong, a Hong Kong student activist and politician who serves as Secretary General of the pro-democracy party Democisto, tells the VOA Mandarin service that the current protests are about more than the extradition bill and more than about Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam. It's about this generation's future after the year 2047 when Hong Kong's current one country, two system status goes away.
Under the threat of Beijing, we have activists being jailed, lawmakers being unseated, publishers were kidnapped, and foreign correspondents being expelled from Hong Kong. And that's why people already experience one country, two system result in one country, one and a half system. And it's triggered more people aware on the crackdown on human rights and continue the fight.
Police said on Monday that while Sunday's demonstration was mostly peaceful, there were breaches of the peace in the evening when some protesters defaced public buildings and aimed laser beams at police officers. It was a far cry from the violent clashes between protesters and riot police throughout the summer, with activists storming the legislature and targeting China's main liaison office in the city. This weekend was also noteworthy for the lack of tear gas used by the police. U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton told VOA special contributor Greta Van Susteren that China needs to think about its next steps.
The Chinese have to look very carefully at the steps they take because people in America remember Tiananmen Square. They remember the picture of the man standing in front of the line of tanks. They remember the statue of Lady Liberty. They remember voices of the Chinese people asking for freedom and democracy, and they remember the repression of the Chinese government in 1989. It would be a big mistake to create a new memory like that in Hong Kong.
But where do things go from here, and what can these protests achieve? For that, I spoke with Scott Harold, senior political scientist with the RAND Corporation and associate director of the RAND Center for Asia-Pacific Policy. I started our conversation by asking him what he saw the chances were of Beijing agreeing to the demonstrators' demands.
Ultimately, although Beijing has postured itself to suggest that it could not give anything on Carrie Lam, in fact, they could certainly toss her overboard, blame her, make her the scapegoat, and that's not at all impossible since they've done that before. On the bigger picture, I think, which is really, could Hong Kong activists effectively force Beijing to revisit its decision that it made in about 2013, 2014, that would be a harder one because that really could set a precedent for forcing the Chinese Communist Party to recognize that Hong Kong has some special status that's more in accord with what the so-called special autonomous regions are actually supposed to be, which is areas of China that have some genuine autonomy, some genuine accountability. On the other hand, as you I'm sure have noted, and as I'm sure your audience has noted, Steve, the attention that Hong Kong is getting and the support it is garnering and gaining worldwide is really quite substantial. So the costs to Beijing are going up the longer that they let this go. In that sense, you could reach a point where it may be the case that if they were to take the first step of replacing the chief executive if she were to develop a health concern or were seen to have reached the end of her run in some way. A new chief executive candidate who may be willing to do things that Hong Kongers really want, like ensure that the police are held to account, set up some kind of an accountability and transparency mechanism, or do an independent investigation of how the police employed rather more violent tactics during this recent incident, then you might begin to see Beijing find a way out where it would not have to necessarily address all of the demands that the protesters are making.
You have this 50-year period that ends in 2047 where the one country, two systems period goes away. What can they actually do to ensure that post-2047 these things remain in place, if that's even possible?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's a really difficult question, right? You know, the basic assumption that was cooked into the deal in 1984 between London and Beijing was essentially London's recognition that it didn't have a very strong hand to play and it would try to get as attractive a deal for Hong Kong elites as it could, and that it would try to preserve the basic rights and expectations for Hong Kong society. But realistically, I think anyone looking at that would have said, well, who knows in 1984 what is the Chinese Communist Party, or what is China going to look like in 2047? It was just too far off, so let's hope for the best. But there was never a specified mechanism of what actually happens in 2047. I think the Chinese Communist Party leadership and those who surround it and work with it have generally tried to erode that and tried to blur the promises, and there's no real way to say definitively what should be happening other than Hong Kong's basic way of life should be preserved between now and 2047. But what happens at 2047? How could you hold the Chinese Communist Party and the People's Republic of China to its word? I think that the real answer there is you do so by really working to mobilize Hong Kong society and global public opinion so as to impose some costs on China that make it hard or impossible or highly undesirable from Beijing's perspectives to really do away with that.
You know, the current leadership in Taiwan has said, you know, the doors are open. Anyone who wants to leave Hong Kong would be welcome there.
Yeah, no, certainly the current president of Taiwan, Tsai Ing-wen, is quite aware that the steps that she takes now will be both commensurate with the Democratic Progressive Party's traditional values and also will have benefits to her personal quest for re-election, and is really damaged. I mean, I think by contrast, it's really damaging to Han Kuo-yu, the current mayor of Kaohsiung, who is running as the KMT, or Nationalist Party's candidate. He is the candidate who is perceived as more favorable to, friendly to, perhaps even backed by, sponsored by, or covertly influenced by Beijing in the most, unfavorable characterizations. And to that extent, being seen as Beijing's cat's paw, being seen as having China's covert or clandestine backing, and giving voice to positions that are favorable to deeper integration with China or more trusting of Chinese government positions.
Scott Harold is a senior political scientist with the RAND Corporation and associate director of the RAND Center for Asia-Pacific Policy. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Steve.
In addition, hundreds of Hong Kong pro-democracy protesters have rallied in Sydney, despite warnings from Beijing for foreign governments and activists not to get involved in the issue. Phil Mercer brings VOA that story.
There have been rallies in Australia's biggest cities in support of and in opposition to pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong. Scuffles broke out between rival groups in Melbourne Friday, while hundreds of pro-Hong Kong supporters gathered in the centre of Sydney Sunday. Many wore face masks, wary of alleged Chinese state surveillance of citizens who publicly support campaigners in Hong Kong. Protesters in Sydney said they were taking a stand against authoritarianism.
We don't want to see our home get into a state where we have to follow the rules that are often not very fair.
Australian is actually supporting us, supporting Hong Kongers. So we don't have to be afraid of any threats from anywhere. So we are all united.
We are here exercising our rights of freedom of speech and support the Hong Kong protesters.
Pro-China groups have also held marches in Australia with chants of Long Live China and If You Don't Love China, You Are Our Enemy. Australia is home to tens of thousands of Chinese students, as well as other migrants from mainland China. The Chinese ambassador to Australia, Chen Yingye, said protesters in Hong Kong had exhibited radical, violent and illegal behaviours. Activists and police have clashed in Hong Kong over the past 10 weeks, and protests were sparked by an extradition bill, which has since been suspended by the Hong Kong government. China has built up security forces in nearby Shenzhen and has compared the protests to terrorism. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison has urged authorities in Hong Kong to listen carefully to what people are saying and work towards a peaceful and calm resolution of what is a very, very serious issue. In Canberra, the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade has urged Australian travellers to exercise a high degree of caution in Hong Kong. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Among other top stories in the world, a study by the UN Children's Fund finds more than 500,000 Rohingya refugee children in Bangladesh's Cox's Bazar are not learning the life skills they need to prepare them for the future or to protect them from present-day abuse and exploitation. Afghanistan's president has vowed to eliminate all safe havens of the Islamic State after a bombing at a wedding late Saturday that killed at least 63 people and another bombing on Monday that wounded at least 66. Former Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir appeared at a Khartoum courtroom on Monday for the start of his trial on corruption charges. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and with our mobile app. This is International Edition.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, historically black colleges and universities in the United States have also educated prominent Africans, like the founding presidents of Nigeria, Ghana, and Malawi. The role of historically black colleges and universities on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, this is James Butty, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05 and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Russian President Vladimir Putin will make a rare visit to his French counterpart, French President Emmanuel Macron's official holiday residence in southern France today. Putin is seldom invited by major Western powers for visits at a time of growing tensions. And just days before, Macron hosts other world leaders, including U.S. President Donald Trump, for the Group of Seven summit. Russia was pushed out of what was the G8 in 2014 after it seized Ukraine's Black Sea Peninsula from Crimea. An annexation the international community has deemed illegal. Now, International Edition's Lori London asked Paris-based reporter Catherine Field about the motivation behind Macron's invitation.
Essentially, Emmanuel Macron has seemed to have gotten the idea that now is the time to make new inroads and give some depth to Franco-Russian relations. There is a feeling that Emmanuel Macron is really the only person with any standing in Europe at the moment. The German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, is weak. She's a weak government. She's going to leave office in the next few years. the United Kingdom, Boris Johnson, can't speak for Europe, and no one knows how long he will be in the job. And Italy, of course, has, you know, again, has got a political crisis underway. So Emmanuel Macron feels that now is the time, as the strong man, the leader of Europe, he can reach out to Vladimir Putin and talk to him about issues that have really been bogging down the relationship, and in particular, that is Ukraine, Iran, Syria, and trade. And he feels that if he gets Vladimir Putin to his summer holiday residence on the Mediterranean, he'll be able to talk to him and get some sort, he hopes, some sort of agreement to get a dialogue going again about Ukraine, and also possibly to get him to use some sort of influence when it comes to Iran.
What about the nuclear issue? Will that be coming up most likely?
Well, there are several nuclear issues that he will want to be talking to Vladimir Putin about. Emmanuel Macron really wants Vladimir Putin to use his influence with Tehran to prevent any further escalation and to get that JCPOA agreement sort of adhered to try and bring something about there, so that there can be a continued dialogue between Europe and Iran, and also with Russia playing a key role there. Also, of course, the other big nuclear issue at the moment is the nuclear weapons. There is a feeling that someone has to talk to Russia and talk about this INF treaty, this arms control, just being ripped apart before everyone's eyes. The French know very well that this nuclear weapon modernization program is underway, that they have to be back at the negotiating table on that. So that is another big issue. Now, of course, France does have nuclear weapons, and it is a permanent member of the Security Council at the UN, so it feels it has a role. And by talking to Vladimir Putin about these issues may just give some clarity as to which way the future is heading.
And what about the G7, the upcoming G7? I know, obviously, Putin won't be there. Has Macron talked at all about whether or not he plans to meet with U.S. President Donald Trump?
We have no word yet as to whether or not there will be a meeting beforehand, a one-on-one with Donald Trump. But, of course, there will be some sort of sideline bilateral, but we've got no issues on that. And this is also another reason why Vladimir Putin is being brought to France, if you like, before the G7 at the end of the week. It's a way of saying, well, you might be shunned by others within the international community because of that 2014 seizing of Crimea and Ukraine, and also with the causing the fighting in eastern Ukraine. So there is also this way of, if you bring Vladimir Putin in here, you can talk to him about the same issues you're going to talk about at the G7, and also Emmanuel Macron will no doubt use that conversation he has with Putin when he's having other discussions later on in the week with other heads of state and government.
What about human rights issues and, of course, the arrests of opponents of the current leadership there in Russia? Do you think that will come up?
Absolutely. Emmanuel Macron has said that he will bring this up. The French foreign minister has said many times that France is concerned about the arrests that are happening in Moscow at the moment. And this could be the one area in their talks where there will be a bit of disagreement. The French president is, of course, very aware of what's going on in Moscow, is very aware in particular of what's happening in the legal system. And let's not forget that just last week, a Russian court released from prison a French businessman who had been in custody. He is now only under house arrest, but the French government had been in touch with the Russian officials about that. So Russia won't be getting off lightly, so it will be interesting to see how much of an emphasis Emmanuel Macron puts on those arrests and those continuing pro-democracy rallies that we're seeing in Moscow.
An Iranian supertanker with $130 million worth of light crude oil that the U.S. suspects is tied to a sanctioned organization has left Gibraltar and was heading Monday to the Mediterranean Sea, with its next destination reported to be Greece. Iranian flag Adrian Dara 1, previously named Grace 1, set course for Kalamata, Greece, with an estimated arrival on August 25th. It wasn't immediately made known why the tanker would be heading there or whether the destination could change. The vessel left Gibraltar late Sunday after having been detained for a month in the British Overseas Territory for allegedly attempting to breach European Union sanctions on Syria. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
According to the recently released Global Climate Report from the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, July 2019 was the hottest month ever recorded in the NOAA Global Temperature Dataset record, which dates back to 1880. The report from scientists at NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information also indicates that the sweltering July heat shrank both Arctic and Antarctic sea ice to historic lows. The average global temperature in July, according to the report, was 0.95 degrees Celsius above the 20th century average of 15.77 degrees Celsius. The previous hottest month on record was July 2016. According to the report, record warm July temperatures were measured across parts of North America, Southern Asia, Southern Africa, the Northern Indian Ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, and across the western and northern parts of the Pacific Ocean. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Every day, cutting-edge research is being performed in government and university labs across the United States. Tech transfer is the process of taking that research out of the lab and transforming it into a business. Once a company jumpstarts the process by introducing entrepreneurs to that research. VOA's Tina Trin explains.
What's unique about these glass foams is that it's made entirely of glass hollow spheres. There is no epoxy or resin, no glue.
When it comes to glass foam, Matthew DeMay knows his stuff. He even co-founded a company that produces the material, which wouldn't be all that surprising until you realize he has no formal training in it. But Navy physicist Aaron Weiss does.
My work with amorphous materials suggested that if you heated the hollow glass spheres, you could get them to bond without any of the filler material.
Weiss originally developed the foam for the Navy. DeMay and his colleagues licensed and started a company with it. Their matchmaker? FedTech, a startup accelerator that pairs aspiring entrepreneurs with government researchers.
When research is done, it creates intellectual property that in theory can be the foundation of amazing new products.
FedTech helps bring those products to market through a process known as tech transfer.
If you think about Department of Defense, NASA, Department of Energy, the National Labs, they're not really in the business of trying to make as much money as possible. Tech transfer is this process of taking tech out of the lab and moving it into a practical application.
Turns out, glass foam isn't just useful in water, but also on land, in safety helmets and body armor. FedTech helped DeMay and team connect the dots.
Understanding how to approach different sets of customers and then finding the problem spaces that our technology could fit into.
As for the physicist who admits he doesn't have a head for business,
to see that product go into the world, hopefully help other people and come back and help the Navy as well, is a really gratifying process.
When it comes to startup ideas, Solomon says young entrepreneurs often go with what they know, creating apps for their everyday life.
I love, you know, consumer-facing products, but man, if we can get, you know, people reaching outside of their comfort zone, starting companies around breakthrough technologies that may, you know, be able to really change people's lives for the better, that's a great thing.
The next unicorn startup might just be in a government lab. Tina Trin, VOA News, Arlington.
And before I go today, we'll take a quick look back in time. It was on this date in 1909. The first automobile races were run at the just-opened Indianapolis Motor Speedway. The winner of the first event was auto engineer Louis Schweitzer, who drove a Stoddard Dayton touring car twice around the 2.5-mile track at an average speed of 92.4 kilometers per hour. And that is going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Mungavi, engineer John Dryden, and managing editor Kate Pound Dawson, thank you so much for listening today. You'll find in-depth coverage of world events and news at the VOA News website. And don't forget, with our mobile app, you can download the stories and take them with you. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Make it a great day.